in association with Newsarama. Welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Earlier in the week, we replayed one of our first Word Balloon episodes ever with writer Mark Andreyko, who had just begun the Tales of Manhunter, the new one from the DC Universe, Kate Spencer. The book has had its ups and downs, but it's back now on the schedule. Issue 31 came out last week, and Mark tells us about the continuing adventures of Kate, the inclusion of artist Michael Gatos, and fills us in with some of the plans he has for the character in the coming future. This episode of Word Balloon is brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com, where they offer a huge selection of hardcovers, trade paperbacks, showcases, absolute editions, archives, essentials, omnibus editions, and more. They're all at up to 35% off with orders over $50 receiving free shipping. And in fact, you can receive all of the trades from the Manhunter series, from Volume 1 all the way up to Volume 4, which would bring us up to date. They retail for $17.99. But the good news is that in stock trades, they're just $11.33. In fact, the first trade, Street Justice, goes for $12.99 retail. The price at InStockTrades.com is $8.18. And don't forget to visit InStockTrades' sister site, Discount Comic Book Service, at DCBService.com for all your pre-order needs, because major publishers are 40% off and monthly specials are 45 to 75% off every month. For more details and more deals, visit InStockTrades at InStockTrades.com and Discount Comic Book Service at DCBService.com. Our conversation with Mark begins with us discussing the return of Kate Spencer in issue 31 of Manhunter. I'll first of all say that I'm really happy that Manhunter is back. I was very pleased with the new issue, and I think it is a great place to jump on for people who haven't had the opportunity to jump on, because I think especially in those first few pages, you give good background on what's happened before and explain the character and surrounding characters really well.
Well, thanks. I'm really, really happy that people seem to like those first two pages, because those were two of the hardest pages I've ever had to write in my life. You know, trying to sum up 30-odd issues into something that is compelling but not overly wordy versus telling something that's completely incoherent was really, really a challenge. But, you know, I'm blessed by having a really, really insightful editor in Joan Hilty, and Michael is doing, I think, the work of his career. If you thought his artwork on this issue was nice, wait till you see issue 32.
Well, let's talk about Gatos for a second, because
excuse me.
No problem. I've always been a fan of his, going back to Alias. Were you a Caliber guy as well?
Oh, yeah, way back in the day. I don't go back with Caliber quite as far as Brian and David Mack do, but I go back about, God, that was like 15 years ago now. Ugh, I'm so old.
What did you write for Caliber?
I co-created a book called The Lost.
Okay.
It was this contemporary dark Peter Pan set in Manhattan.
Oh, yes, okay.
With Jay Geldof from Grendel fame, he did like Grendel and Mystery and Congorilla and Galen Showman and Mark Ricketts.
Very cool. And yeah, I was going to say, I know Mark for a fact is at the Lurid Forum. Is Jay also at the Lurid Forum?
I don't know. I haven't really kept in touch with Jay.
Okay.
I know he's a fairly new dad, so I'm assuming that the internet is probably far down on the list of things when you have a new baby.
I understand. Now, was Gatos at Caliber or no?
Yeah, Gatos did stuff at Caliber, but I didn't meet Michael until 5 or 6 years ago. And then last year's San Diego convention, I saw him again for the first time in years. And I have as a gift for all the writers who were doing monthly books at the time of One Year Later, Dan DiDio gave 1 Year Later sketchbooks to people. And I've never been a big sketchbook person, but since I have like a character I kind of created at DC, I decided to ask all the people I knew to just do Manhunter sketches. So it's a book full of sketches of just Manhunter.
Oh, that's great.
Oh, and it's, yeah, I want to publish it someday because it's got like, you know, Michael Golden and George Perez and Brian Hitch and, you know, all these people who I shouldn't be friends with, who I am friends with, which is weird because it's like, oh, I've been a fan of George's since I was 6 years old, and now we exchange Christmas cards. And
well, if it was cool with the artist, could you put it in a trade, conceivably, or something?
I don't know. If I had a scanner, I could probably put them on a website.
Okay. There you go.
But I'm still, you know, I still have the cell phones like they had in the Vietnam War where you crank it on the backpack. So, you know.
Nice.
Mike did. I had Mike do a Manhunter sketch for me, and the sketch. And he had never read the book, and I gave him some reference, and I got the sketch back, and I said, for somebody that never read the book, you really totally captured her, and the sketch really stayed with me. And when we got uncanceled the second time, we were looking for artists, and the first artist who was available, because we did some shifts and changes with the story arcs, he became not available. And then they asked me if I knew anybody, and I had been in Spain for a convention, and Michael was there, and I said to him, I said, wow, what are you doing now? And he's like, nothing. I'm like, you want to draw Manhunter? And the rest, as they say, is history.
That's fantastic. Well, you know, I was a fan of his during Alias, and Kate, much like Jessica Jones, is that kind of every woman character that I think is perfect for Gatos to draw.
Well, yeah, and it's also, too, unlike Alias, it's a little bit more in the superhero realm.
Sure.
There's going to be a more costumes in it, so it's interesting to see Michael flex his muscles and draw superheroes and things that he never isn't really known for. But I got to tell you, his Blue Beetle is amazing looking.
Very cool.
You only get a hint of it on that page in the last issue, but he draws a killer Blue Beetle. So
that's excellent. Well, and I was happy to see his Arn Monroe, and that's the one thing I like about the series, that you've taken a lot of interesting periphery characters. I mean, Arn Monroe, really, we haven't seen him regularly beyond your series.
Since All-Star.
Exactly. And that, you know, and then another great Roy Thomas character, Obsidian, who's been a regular supporting character in your series. It's fun that you've put these, surrounded Kate with these heroes, because I think that only anchors her more to the DCU.
Well, yeah, I totally agree. I've always said that a good, well-developed supporting cast does not take away from your lead. It only informs people about the character even more, you know, because we are all judged by who we surround ourselves with. And, you know, I've always been I've always been a sucker for things with big casts, whether it was, you know, the John Byrne, Chris Claremont X-Men, or the Marv Wolfman, George Perez Teen Titans, or the films of Robert Altman, whether in Nashville, or something like The Big Chill. When you have a lot of characters, you just get a richer tapestry. It's more challenging, you know, from a writing standpoint, because the biggest challenge I think writers face universally is trying to make sure the characters all have unique voices and don't just sound like you. But that's a fun challenge. You know, I'm just finishing up the final script on an issue of Manhunter, and I rewrote this one scene more than I've rewritten anything in my life. And I was talking to my editor, and I was like, you know, it was really difficult, but not in a bad way. It was really, really. You know, I was like, no, that doesn't sound, no, she wouldn't say that. She, you know, so it's really interesting to get to a point where the characters are so real that you really know what they sound like.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a circuitous answer to a question I've forgotten, so forgive me.
No, we were talking, I think we were talking about the cast of characters that you've surrounded Kate with. And another question I have is, in terms of the immediacy, how long is this first arc going to be?
Six issues.
Okay.
Six issues. Generally, I know everyone's like, oh, six issues, it's made for the trade. Well, that is definitely a consideration. But six issues, coming from a background of, you know, writing plays and screenplays and television stuff, that three-act structure works. It's easier to break a story down in multiples of three.
Sure.
So if it's three issues or six issues or nine issues. No, you know, I'm not married to that. I don't, you know, I don't sit here with my Sid Field book and say, on page 15, this needs to happen. But if you've lived in the United States and done anything involved in pop culture, you've absorbed the rhythms of storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
So breaking it down into multiples of three allows me to say, well, the story needs to get to this point by the end of this issue. Not necessarily, you know, if that makes any sense. It gives me more touchstones, because otherwise, in four issues or three things like that, sometimes the story gets too front loaded or too back loaded, because you realize, oh shit, I only have one more issue left. I haven't told anybody what this is really about.
That's, sure.
Oh, I'm not allowed to swear on your show.
No, you can. Absolutely, dude. It's the internet. Say whatever you want.
Oh, good. Just wanted to get one of those in there.
There you go. I know in the initial run you tied the first arc into Identity Crisis, which probably was a big help to start the character off. Will there be events in Manhunter reflecting what's going on in Final Crisis in any way, or any of the other?
I'll reflect the events of the DC Universe as they're applicable to the story I'm trying to tell.
Okay.
Will we be doing any direct crossovers? There's nothing planned. That's not to say it won't happen, but at this point, I think, and I think you can probably tell if you've read, you know, after reading issue 31, we're kind of operating in our own little corner of the DC Universe.
Sure.
I'll be using other characters from the DC Universe, and I won't be contradicting anything, but I'm not going to be, you know, ultra married to everything that's going on right now. I don't have to worry about that stuff. I can't counteract it, but I don't have to really, I don't have to worry about what's happening in Final Crisis 3.
Okay. Again, going back to this being a legacy character, it's interesting that I think in the initial run we were led down one corridor thinking that, Kate had ties to... I don't want to... it's funny. On the one hand, I want to kind of talk about things that have happened, but then again, people might be new to the character, and I realize that the other arcs
are
collected.
I'm actually totally comfortable talking about that stuff because
okay,
I don't think anything that we're going to... We're not going to go into any sort of ultra-nuanced detail that I think if we talk about it, I'm comfortable that because all the trades are available and in print that people can go look that stuff up.
Okay, well then...
If we get to a point where you think we're just doing books on tape of the stories, we can pull back. But I don't mind. That stuff exists out there. It's not going to be spoiling it for anyone.
Okay. Well, it's cool that again, she has these ties to the Golden Age. Initially thinking that maybe she was tied to the Atom, but turning out that again, Iron Monroe is one of her grandparents, and that her grandmother was the original Phantom Lady. That's pretty cool.
Well, it's very funny. The whole root of how of Kate's parentage and then the lineage extending onto her grandparents and beyond, where we ended up was not where I originally had planned on going. The character who I originally wanted to make Kate's father wasn't available, and so I was forced to think of other things. And then I thought, well, what about the Atom? And then researching that, I realized that's kind of the story of Damage.
Right,
and the character Damage.
Sure.
And I talked to Jeff Johns about it, as he's the arbiter of all things JSA, and I asked him, what do you think? What should go on here? And he had said, that he didn't feel that Al would abandon, because originally it was going to be Al having a one-night stand with Phantom Lady.
Okay.
And it was just one of those moments where it never would have happened if they had waited two more seconds, it wouldn't have happened. But one of those things that just, they're at war, there's all that stress going on, she's in Iraq, there's all sorts of things. And Jeff kind of said to me, he said, I don't really feel that Al that's in Al's character. And I looked at it, I said, okay. So then I looked a little deeper and I thought about Iron Monroe, and I thought, that makes sense.
It does.
And Iron Monroe is a character too that there's not a lot about him out there, so it's not like I have a lot of continuity about him to worry about.
Certainly,
not that I'm going to play fast and loose with everything. Ultimately, I'm going to try and serve. I'm not going to counteract the existing stuff. It's just one of those characters that seemed, one, no one was really interested in, and two, he was pretty much a blank slate. But also at the same time, was deeply ingrained into the history of the DC universe. So Kate makes Kate a legacy character in a really weird sort of way.
Well, yeah, because it was a continuity implant by Roy Thomas to kind of fill that void of Superman not being around to be in the original JSA, and he came up with all those young all-stars to kind of fill a bunch of places of Earth 2 characters that were wiped out of existence because of the crisis. And also, I like the fact that Iron Monroe was always kind of a guy that didn't take the superpowers seriously and seemed to kind of be, one of those kind of fast and loose guys that would hook up with.
Oh, yeah, he was totally, for lack of a more elegant term, a pussyhound.
Yes.
That was always, that was always a major part of his character, going back and rereading that stuff,
Yeah.
And the same thing with, going back to things that are implied with characters or, projected onto characters, going back with Obsidian. I remember, I loved, I'm a huge Roy Thomas fan. I love All-Star Squadron. I loved Infinity Inc. I loved all that stuff.
Very cool.
In a dream world, I'd love to write, maybe I could co-write this with Jeff, a JSA Invaders crossover. I would love to do that.
I'm all someday. For it.
put me on the list with the 300 other people who are much more successful commercial writers than me. But, if I kill them all, maybe someday I'll get to do something like that. But going back to Obsidian, I had always been a fan of Obsidian, and whether it was when Jerry Ordway was drawing the original Infinity Inc. or when Todd was first bursting on the scene, Todd McFarlane with those crazy layouts and all that stuff. And then I knew that Gerard Jones had danced around the issue of him being gay in the 90s, and probably went as far as the times would allow. It seems kind of corny going back now and looking at that stuff, but at the time, I'm sure that was really kind of pushing the envelope.
Okay.
And then when I went back and reread the original Infinity Inks and stuff, Todd, whether Roy wanted it or not, Todd has always seemed like a guy in the closet. You know, he didn't have many girlfriends at all.
True.
The one girlfriend that he actually really had during the course of Infinity Inc. turned out to be, ironically enough, a Manhunter from the Millennium crossover.
Oh, you know, I totally forgot that. Good call.
She was like the Harlequin's daughter or something, and had like, you know, turned out to be a mannequin or a Manhunter robot. And then Todd was just really, you know, really protective of his sister.
Right.
And then what you know, touching on what Gerard Jones had done in Justice League International, he had, you know, had this crush, sort of amorphous, weird, is it because we're just best friends or is it because I'm in love with him sort of relationship with Nuklon. And, you know, I did go into Manhunter saying that I wanted to have a gay character in the book. I wanted to have a gay character who didn't have AIDS, hadn't been gay bashed, wasn't a drag queen. I wanted to do a better looking, in better shape equivalent of me, just a boring guy who happens to be gay. And I wanted him to have a superhero boyfriend, so Obsidian was the most logical, organic fit. That's the thing, too, that I tried to do, you know, like having the trial of Shadow Thief in the beginning of Manhunter tying into Identity Crisis, or tying in the OMAX to the history of the Manhunter character, mm-hmm. or kind of the revisionism that I did with the Mark Shaw Manhunter and tying that into the Azrael mythos. None of the stuff that I did wasn't hinted at or suggested or had threads that felt organic. I don't like change for the sake of change. I wanted to make sure that these stories were interesting and that if you went back and looked at the continuity that they fit, but I didn't want the continuity to be holding everything by the throat, because I think a lot of times continuity in comics is the flea on the tail that wags the dog.
Yep.
And, you know, the best way to deal with continuity is generally done in soap operas. If you've watched a soap opera for a week, you get and understand the characters. But if you've watched it for 30 years, there are nods to things that you would know. But if you don't know them, it doesn't impede your enjoyment of the process at all.
I get you.
You know, so that's a really long-winded answer.
No, that's good. Diatribes are welcome, man. Don't even sweat it.
Okay.
It's cool. And Mr. Bones, always happy to see him, another great character from Infinity
Inc. Blast to write, too. He and Kate have a really intense scene in the upcoming issue, and a scene that I'm actually really proud of the way it came out. It was one of the more difficult things I've had to write, and yeah, I love Bones. I think he's a great character.
And I like, you know, Kate, if for people who don't know, Kate is a lawyer that started off as a prosecutor and became a defense
Kate
attorney.
Yeah, Kate Spencer started out as a federal prosecutor based in Los Angeles who specialized in prosecuting supervillain crime. And after she got sick of these supervillains getting out and manipulating the system and, you know, going to Arkham and then getting out or all that sort of thing, specifically after she lost a case where Copperhead was found not guilty of eating 15 people by reason of genetic anomaly, and then he just proceeded to escape and go kill people again. So she built herself a costume out of the evidence locker of confiscated supervillain gear. And then later on in the series, during the one-year-later gap, she switched sides. She went from being a federal prosecutor to being a defense attorney and kind of playing both sides of the fence in representing supervillains and, you know, kind of totally could get her disbarred, but using that to be able to find out information about what the villains were. You know, sort of like being a mob lawyer who's also a narc.
Sure.
And also, that was a suggestion from Dan DiDio to make her a defense attorney, and I think it makes it all the more interesting.
Well, yeah, and it is interesting because it's – forgive me. I mean, obviously, you can't help but think of Matt Murdock, but Kate is a very different character. She's a working mom, and that is always, you know, the curse and blessing, I think, of her life in terms of, you know, having to always be concerned with Ramsey and what's going on with him and, you know, having to balance not only the attorney life but the hero life with also knowing that she's got to be a mom and a better mom than – her estranged, you know, her ex-husband will, you know, ever consider her to be.
Well, that's what's been great about it. You know, I always, you know, people say, well, why didn't you do Manhunter as a creator-owned book? And I said, well, because I wanted to do a book firmly set in the DC Universe dealing with these issues that aren't really part and parcel for the DC Universe. And the thing that's great about having a character like Manhunter, because she's not a Saturday morning cartoon yet or a theme park ride or on Band-Aids or, you know, this huge billion-dollar industry, I can have actual change in the character. If you read her in issue 1 and you read her in issue 30, there's been a lot of growth and change in her as a person. Whereas when you're working with some of the big icons, because, you know, you have to, a lot of that is rearranging furniture in really interesting ways. And I don't mean that in a reductive way. I mean, to be able to tell a really good Superman story or a really good Batman story in continuity, if you can pull that off, you're damn good. Yeah, because, you know, how those characters have been around for, what, going on 70 years. And, you know, how many stories, you know, it's like you know, if you can write an interesting episode of Friends, good for you, because there are certain touchstones that have to be in every adventure. You know what I mean?
Sure.
You're not going to be able to make Ross a transsexual murderer, or you're not going to be able to make Batman, a priest. There are just certain things that aren't going to be able to you're not going to be able to do. But in Manhunter, I've been able to do that, and DC has been supportive the whole way. So
that's cool. And you know, it had to have helped having Kate solidify her place in the DCU by the appearances in Birds of Prey, and you know, just being in the periphery. I'm glad. Now, was that, you know, did Gail request her? I mean, how did that work out?
Well, Gail has been one of the earliest and most vocal supporters of Manhunter, and it really means a lot to me because, you know, writing a book with a female lead, I wanted to make sure that she didn't just sound like me. You know, I wanted to make sure that I captured as much as I could of that. And Gail, having, you know, Joan Hilty as the editor of the book helps, having a female presence. And Gail's been so supportive, you know, been the town crier about, you know, reading Manhunter. And she asked if she could use Kate in a couple of story arcs, and I said, yeah, you don't even have to ask me. You know, I trust you. You know, I love to read the scripts in advance if I can, just to see where the book's going. But, you know, other than that, have a ball. So I've been really, really flattered by her appearances in Birds of Prey.
Very cool. You know, when we first spoke 3 years ago, I mentioned that I had hoped for the eventual pajama party featuring the birds and Kate, you know.
That would be awesome.
With the obligatory pillow fight, so.
Well, know. I want to do, since it turns out that, you know, Kate's lineage makes her second or third cousin to Jack Knight, I want to do it. I would love to, now that James is back in comics, and I've been saying this everywhere, so hopefully he'll read it and pick me up on it. I'd love to do an issue with Kate and Ramsey and Jack and his son, and they're just out sitting in Golden Gate Park having a picnic and just talking about life. No costumes, no supervillain attacks, just two cousins who are both single parents of a young kids talking about, isn't it weird that we got to this place?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I was going to ask about that because I wasn't certain if Sandra and Ted, I remembered them being cousins. I wasn't certain.
Yeah, they're
that.
Cousins. They're
okay.
Cousins.
That's hilarious, man. I mean, so yeah, there's just this crazy 6 degrees of separation with.
And once again, that wasn't planned. I didn't particularly go after Sandra to go after Phantom Lady to say, "Oh, I want to, you know,
hook her into Starman."
I don't want to hook myself into to you know, Starman's glory. It was just one of those again, those happy accidents. So.
Sure.
And I'm Starman is the standard bearer for, you know, kind of taking rusty old legacy names and making them interesting and character-driven.
No question.
So, you know, Manhunter would not exist if Starman didn't blaze the path decades before.
That's cool. Now, I noticed, too, when you mentioned earlier that obviously Kate assembled her outfit and weapons from former supervillain things, and I guess in Manhunter 15 we learned that where the various things came from.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to let people know.
Oh, sure. Kate's the gauntlets come from from Azrael.
Okay.
I'm not going to tell you how she got them in the story. You need to go out and get trade number 3. I think the third trade has issue 15 in it.
Sounds right.
The little stories in there I'm really proud of, and Sean Phillips drew this, the one about the gauntlets, and it's amazing.
Very cool.
The bodysuit is a Dark Star suit. If anybody remembers the Dark Stars, they were kind of like replaced the Green Lanterns in the around like Zero Hour and Genesis and all those.
Yep.
Mid to late 90s crossovers. and the actual power staff is the staff from Mark Shaw. So that's an actual piece of Manhunter gear.
Very cool.
That's not the last we've heard about, you know, talking about the costume pieces. There will be some issues with the costume and ownership and things that, yeah, that's cryptic enough. There will be costume issues coming up. But no symbiotes, I promise.
And no wardrobe malfunctions, unfortunately, probably.
Who's to know?
Okay, fair enough. Very cool. The current arc involves some things going on right on the Mexican border, and as you said, we saw the Blue Beetle for a second, the new Blue Beetle.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to, you know, tease people in terms of where we are right now as far as issue
one? Well, sure. part of the edict of when we got the uncancellation the second time was DC wanted us to deal with sort of real world issues in the context of a superhero world. And that was right up my alley because there's been a number of real world things that I think are either not talked about or could use some more exposure and that would fit in. You could fit in superhero stuff into the issues themselves without cheapening them too much.
Okay.
You know, you also don't want to suddenly make a serious issue all about, you know, alien starfish. But this first arc is dealing predominantly with the murders and disappearances of hundreds of women between El Paso, Texas, and Ciudad Juarez in Mexico. Over the past decade or so, over 400 women have been murdered, and according to some counts, over 1,000 have just disappeared. And I kind of explained this in the first issue of this Manhunter arc in issue 31, but the authorities don't think it's obviously one man doing this. They think it's kind of become, because these killings have been unsolved and because of police corruption and because of, you know, ultimately, you know, it's just some women, you know, that's the attitude that they think that, you know, might be in addition to gangs and that sort of thing. They think that now, you know, abusive husbands and boyfriends who have killed their significant others are just, you know, taking them and dumping them out in the desert. And, you know, who knows if a serial killer wanted to go down there, it's ripe for the picking because there's already, you know, the case is already so sprawling that it's become a kind of like an amusement park for killing women. And, you know, part of something that Kate says and that I agree with is, you know, a blonde 18-year-old girl from America disappears while on vacation in Aruba. It's very tragic, but 400 women are dead 2 miles from an American city. Why isn't that on the news? You know, I don't mean to sound righteously indignant, but 400 women over the course of 10 years. How long was Lacey Peterson on the news?
No kidding.
And once again, I'm not belittling the tragedy of these women, of, you know, Lacey Peterson or Natalie Holloway. They're horrible tragedies. But when you take a horrible tragedy and multiply it by 400, what else do we have to do to get, you know, why aren't we doing anything about this? Most of the press for it is in the, you know, kind of the LA Weekly, Village Voice sort of outlets, not in the New York Times sort of outlets. And it's just really kind of, you know, you begin to understand why women and people of color begin to feel that there's a bias.
This is what I always find interesting about your stories. You are a guy that really does get into true crime and look for true crime to reflect in your stories. I know it seemed like Sam and Twitch always had a tie to realism. Even when things got, you know, kind of crazy in a couple, like I remember Ancient Chinese Secret, that arc, for example, I know got a little bit into Chinese mysticism. But a lot more of them, like I remember one of the stories involving Twitch, and again, I don't remember the specifics, but it was a great story about an incident in his past, and I believe it involved his daughter.
Yeah, that tied into Brian Bendis' first arc on the other Sam and Twitch book.
Oh, okay.
It was kind of a sequel to what he had hinted on.
Very cool. You know, I thought your run on Sam and Twitch, if I can transition, was fantastic. I love the grayscales, and it really was one of my favorite series. It you know, I think you had a lot of trouble maybe on the art side in terms of getting issues out, but it was always a joy when it did come out. And
you're
one
of the four people that liked it.
That's too bad, man. Because honestly, I was going to say,
no, it didn't get bad reviews. It was just a matter of it didn't sell very well because, you know, it had the when we came out was not exactly the best time in comics. You know,
yeah,
when we had started, we were the comics. You know, the world for comics is a much better place now, and it's still not that great.
No, I know what you mean, but I hope that one day McFarlane will kind of release those stories because I think they were great.
He has plans to eventually, I think. And, like, you know, and I'm kind of the Jerry Lewis of crime comics because one of the Sam and Twitch arcs, the arc with the gay senator.
Yes.
That was nominated for an award, an audience award at Angoulême.
Okay.
Angoulême, the French. So me and Jerry Lewis were big in France.
No, man, I like I say, I was. I was a big fan of the your continuation and... Yeah, I was disappointed when the series just kind of petered out, but I'm glad that you're, you know, back and working at stuff, you know, now with the DCU. And I think, again, Manhunter is a character. I'm glad to hear that they want to steer the stories towards crime, real crime, and keep it a relevant book because, yeah, I think it serves the character well.
I want to explore these issues because from a writing standpoint, trying to merge real life tragedies and horrors in a fictional universe is an exciting challenge for a writer. And also, you know, I'm not telling these stories to be didactic. I'm not saying this is what you should do, and that's one to grow on. I'm hopefully just raising some questions and hoping people will look up, will be compelled enough to say, this Juarez stuff is true, and research it a little, you know, kind of like some of the best comics of my youth did. Hopefully it'll inspire people to look elsewhere.
Absolutely.
This is by no means Marx's soapbox, and this isn't what you should feel politically and what you should think, because I don't necessarily agree with Kate's points of view. You know, and she's my main character, so this isn't a soapbox for me. It's just trying to tell stories that have an urgency and an interest level.
Well, tell me about working with Joan Hilty, because I've only spoken with Jen Van Meter and Greg Rucka in terms of their experiences as having her as an editor. And I'm glad to hear that she is still involved with the DCU, because I understood it during con season that she's going to be doing a lot of stuff for Vertigo as well.
Yeah, Manhunter is her only DC book that she kept.
Wow.
Which makes me very happy, because when I got the phone call from her, and she's like, she said, I have something to tell you. My first call was, oh, you're going to Marvel. She's like, no. I said, oh, man, we're canceled again. She's like, no. She said, I'm going to Vertigo, but I'm keeping Manhunter. And I said, good, because truthfully, I can't sing Joan's praises highly enough. Joan is, if I could only work with Joan as an editor for the rest of my life, I would be a very lucky man. Joan is one of those rare breeds of editor who, when I talk to her and get notes from her, I'm excited and I want to write, as opposed to want to go cut my wrists and cry in the corner. She doesn't try and write the book herself. Her suggestions are always completely organic and nine times out of ten better than what I had originally put in there. So the fact that Joan is keeping it, just keeping Manhunter, makes me really happy and really honored, because I adore her. I would crawl through glass for her. She's an amazing editor and an amazing support and just a good all around good person. So
very cool.
Kind of annoying, actually.
In setting up our interview, you mentioned that you might have a couple other things going on that you wanted to talk about.
I have a project from Wildstorm coming out towards the end of summer. Beginning of fall. I can't give you any more details than that, because there will be an announcement at San Diego.
Okay.
I know. It sounds very cloak and dagger, but we got to do what we can to get our moments of press.
Sure.
I'm talking to I got a couple other irons in the fire. I'm talking to some other people at other companies. Nothing that's definite or concrete enough yet to talk about without jinxing it. So there will be at least two, possibly four announcements at San Diego.
Okay, wow, that's great. Are there...
Theoretically, at any moment, all could crash and burn and crumble to the ground, so... hopefully.
Are you getting to play with the DC characters that you want to play with, for the most part?
For the most part, once again, it's a matter of, you know, finding ones that fit into stories, that feel like real fits in the stories. I have not come up across anything where I've been told absolutely not, or if when a character has been unavailable, I've always found someone who fills that void, and generally those times the characters that I ended up getting and make for a better end result.
That's cool.
Iron Monroe and Phantom Lady being perfect examples of that.
Yeah, I'm curious who you were trying to get that you didn't...
I'm not going to tell you.
All right.
Maybe at San Diego over a drink, I'll tell you, but not for public consumption.
Fair enough. I won't be in San Diego this year.
It's not that controversial. I just don't think it's, you know, it's not cool. It's not fair.
Okay. No, that's cool, man. I wanted to go back because I just had Pete Craig Russell on a couple weeks ago.
Oh, Craig, one of my dear friends. I love Craig.
And he mentioned, you know, we talked a little bit about you writing the Doctor Strange story. What is it that disturbs you, Stephen?
Yeah.
Good God. Well, tell me about your end of the story on that.
Well, I've been a fan of Craig's for years. I grew up in Ohio, and I have been reading comics since I was four, and I have been working in comic book stores from about the age of 12 on. And I went to Kent State University in Ohio. Yes, that one, where the four students were killed in the 70s. Yeah,
yep.
That's the one. And Craig lived there. Craig and at the time Jill Thompson and a couple other comic book artists, Jay Geldof and some other people. And I met Craig, and we became friends. And at the time, I remember Craig talking about how he wished he could kind of go back and do a director's cut of his annual, the annual he did, because of, you know, things of, you know, projects change and some of them don't come out the way you want them and that sort of thing. And I said, well, why don't you, you know, Marvel, it was at the time when Marvel was doing a lot of really interesting stuff, the last time they were doing a lot of interesting stuff pre-Joe Quesada.
Yes.
This was when Bob Harris was still around. And I said to Craig, I said, why don't you call Bob Harris and see if they'll do a director's cut and you can, you know, fill in the pages that you'd want to fill in. And he called, and I asked him who was going to write it, and Craig said, well, you are. And I said, oh, really? And Marvel's okay with that? And he said, yeah. I'm like, oh, the powers of Craig Russell. And he doesn't wield them, often, and he doesn't use them for evil. And what initially was going to just be kind of a filling in, you know, lost footage, Craig's style had changed so much, he wanted to redraw the whole thing. So we plotted it out together, and then he drew it, and we went in and back in and did the dialogue, and, you know, the rest, as they say, is history. And it was a complete joy working with, having someone as talented as Craig be a friend is freaky enough to me, and actually getting a chance to work on him on one of the characters, you know, that I think he draws best is also, and having it be like one of my first big jobs is kind of retarded. You know, it's kind of like being Brad Pitt and Thelma and Louise. It's like, okay, how did I get to get here?
I hear
it's like
you.
Being Brad Pitt, but with less hair and a bigger belly.
Do you want to get back? Do you ever want to get back to Doctor Strange?
I would kill to write Doctor Strange. I know exactly what I would do with Doctor Strange. I know. I'm not a big hypester, overconfident guy about many things. But I know people would dig my Doctor Strange. Doctor Strange and Cloak and Dagger are the characters that I would give my eye teeth to do at Marvel.
Wow, are you in line with the others that have pitched Cloak and Dagger to Marvel, and they're just kind of...
I don't really have a lot of connections at Marvel. I know some people over there. I need to start, you know, shaking the rafters a little bit more. And, you know, people like, you know, people like, well, Bendis is one of your best friends. I'm like, yeah, but, you know. I kind of want to be my own guy.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
No, I do.
And believe me, if I'm not proud, if I was going to get evicted, I would call Brian and say, "Hey, can you get me a fill-in issue of something?" But I kind of want to blaze my own path for a while. I've been chatting with some people at Marvel about some stuff. So hopefully, I grew up being a Marvel kid, so I would love to go back there and play in that sandbox someday. But we'll see what happens. You know, they've got the marketplace is really weird right now. There's lots of exclusives that have to be served in order to justify their paychecks. So, and with these big events that seem to be the storytelling du jour, stuff is planned so far in advance. It's tough, you know?
Sure. Well, it seems, too, that Marvel is kind of, especially in the case of Doctor Strange, just kind of, you know, the occasional miniseries here or Bendis using him in Avengers.
Character. He's a hard character. He's a hard character to kind of wrap your brain around, and I think Joe Quesada actually said this, and I'm not sure if he said this in reference to Doctor Strange or in reference to Cloak and Dagger, but he was talking about, you know, maybe he wasn't even talking about either of these characters, but it's applicable to them, that a lot of pitches are just kind of retelling, continuing
yeah.
what's been going on before, and if that was successful, those books would still be going on.
Sure.
Do you know what I mean? So there needs to be, you know, and I agree with him. When he finds the right take, he'll know it's the right take to kind of make these characters, you know, kind of play up the strengths of what makes them everlasting characters, but also give them some oomph to make them a more viable character in the monthly marketplace.
Well, and I also believe, and I've had this discussion with other creators as well and want to know your opinion, I think there are just certain characters that maybe are only made for either teen books or the occasional miniseries. I'm sorry to see the Martian Manhunter go, but by the same token, I don't know if that, you know, if he's capable of really kind of sustaining and ongoing.
Well, it makes me wish that we still had that the marketplace would still support things like, you know, Showcase Presents.
Sure.
Or back in the day, Marvel Premiere.
Yep.
Where you could do a book that was going to a three-part Man-Wolf story or
right.
a two-part, you know, John Jones story. Because I think you're right. I think doing a monthly book, unless it's something that you have a grand overview, a grand design for, and, you know, like with Brian doing Ultimate Spider-Man, that's obviously his baby and a giant masterwork.
Sure.
But when, you know, some characters just don't resonate on a level like that. And also too, it's sometimes that lightning in the bottle of finding the right creator. If you would have told DC Comics 20 years ago that Sandman would be not only one of their most profitable characters, but one of their most critically acclaimed, award-winning characters, they would have laughed you out of their office. But Neil was the right guy at the right time, and, you know, there was a perfect storm of talent and character and opportunity and being in the public, you know, being in the zeitgeist of consciousness at the time. So I agree with you, but at the same token, I'm open to the possibility that finding the right alchemy for a book could make a character.
I'm with you. No,
more
I hear what
alive.
You're saying.
So I know I sound very much like a politician. I agree with you, but
no problem, man. You're not running for office.
But those instances of people like, you know, Neil on Sandman or James Robinson on Starman are very, very rare.
Yes. So. No, I agree. Now, the first time we spoke, we got in a lot of the minutiae about Torso. And mm-hmm. and I, you know, am a huge fan of that book still. And I'm wondering now, because based on what I've seen on the Bendis board and little talk here and there, the movie seemed pre-strike to have a little bit more momentum than it did a couple years ago. Any updates?
We're actually dealing with a lot of that stuff right now. As it stands right now, it's in active development at Paramount Pictures.
Okay.
With David Fincher.
Great. I'm glad he's still involved. Okay.
Yeah. And other than that, I am loath to reveal anything because I'm not sure what I am allowed to talk about that isn't out there for public knowledge.
No problem.
And Bill Mechanic is attached as the producer, and I adore Bill Mechanic. He's used to run a little movie studio called Fox and greenlit a couple of movies called Moulin Rouge and Titanic and The X-Men and Fight Club.
Little movies.
He's a good one. He's
just
one of those
the art
guys
house
that
stuff.
I wish we could clone him and put one of him at every studio because he's one of those guys who, in addition to absolutely being passionate and loving cinema, he's a really good person.
That's cool.
Having him on the project is fantastic because I'm a big fan of what he did when he was a studio executive, and he has been, you know, a guy with his power level shouldn't take my phone call, and he always does.
That's great.
So he's great. So having him helping shepherd the project is a real bonus. So we'll see. I mean, these things, you know, I always kind of half joke that I'll believe it when the check clears or I'm at the premiere.
Well, being a Chicago guy, I really do love the story of Elliot Ness, and it is so much more interesting than what we see in the Untouchables.
Brian and I said this when we were doing the rounds with Torso the first time, that the story of the Untouchables, as it was in the movies and TV, was about 85% fiction and 15% fact.
Yep.
Whereas Torso's the other way around. It's about 85% fact and 15% fiction. We fudge the timeline of the case because the case was over, like, I think 11 or 12 years. And the two unknowns are kind of amalgamations of existing cops from the time and some nuances we wanted to bring. But other than that, most of it's real. You know, it's one of those things where we wish we could take credit for the great idea of having Elliot Ness fight a serial killer, you know, but stuff like that and him using the very first lie detector test in the case, one of the suspects sent him taunting postcards and notes. I mean, you can't make that stuff up.
No, and again, if people haven't picked up Torso, I highly recommend you do. It's a great collaboration between you and Brian Bendis. And
well, it was a lot of fun because I've Brian and I have been friends for quite a long time, and he's one of my best friends in the world, and we wanted to work together, but our styles are really different. I don't think uncomplimentary styles, but our styles are really different. And when we did Torso, Brian was a different writer than he is now. Brian, up until that point, had been writing primarily for himself. You know, he'd mm-hmm. been writing, drawing, lettering, doing the ads, printing it, you know, cutting down the trees, making the paper, smelting the staples, all that stuff. I think I was one of the first big collaborations with him. And, you know, one, to see him go on to the fame and the success that he's gotten, it's totally deserved because Brian is a great guy, and, you know, I think his passion for what he does shines through. I think that's why he's become so successful, because a reader can tell when someone really loves what they're doing. But getting to work with, you know, getting to work with friends and having the experience be great as opposed to friendship ending is always a pleasure.
Sure.
You know, because you don't. Sometimes you want to be really leery about working with friends, but in our case, I think it was fantastic. I'd love to do it again someday when he gets the time and if I can afford him.
Hey, another thing we spoke about last time was, and we found out we both liked a lot of British TV. And I know you were a big fan of Wire in the Blood at the time. And
oh yeah, I just finished watching the new series.
That's cool.
Although I miss Hermione Norris.
But did you see her on Spooks?
I've never seen Spooks.
Oh, you're kidding?
No.
You know that's MI5. That's the. It's.
Oh, okay. Okay. No. Well, I've never seen MI5 either.
Okay. It's. She was.
No, I've heard great things about it. It's one of those things that I need to. You know, when I see it cheap on Amazon.com for season one, I'll get it because it looks like it's right up my alley. But I have not yet. My DVD collection is so out of control. And now that I've gotten a Blu-ray player, it's like replacing things for the 15th time.
Oh, God.
But Blu-ray is life-changing. If you have never watched a Blu-ray movie on a high-def television, it's like taking peyote and having the movie be performed live in front of you.
Wow.
It's higher definition than real life. No, seriously.
Wow.
Yeah, it's amazing.
That's cool. Well, what if, you know, did you watch last year's Jekyll on BBC?
Oh, I loved Jekyll. I love Jekyll, and I love the fact that guy might be the next Doctor Who.
No kidding.
Yeah, he's in the running for it.
Oh, that's great, because, you know, I just saw a three-part miniseries that he wrapped up called Midnight Man.
Oh, I love him. I thought his performance in Jekyll, and what initially when I heard about the concert, I'm like, how many times can we revisit the Jekyll and Hyde?
Sure.
They're not going to be able to do anything interesting with it. And they mixed crime thriller with science fiction and horror and family drama, and that guy's performance was, you know, other than contact lenses, some hair gel, and some fake teeth, there's no makeup in that movie.
Yeah,
and it was so amazing.
James Nesbitt is the actor we're talking about.
Yeah, he's brilliant.
Yeah, have you watched Murphy's Law?
No, I have not. I had just gotten by recommendation of Mark Millar. Oops, I dropped that name. Let me pick it up. He last year recommended a show called The Sweeney to me.
Yes.
That's unbelievable.
That's hilarious. I've been watching The Sweeney as well. And
yeah, it's amazing stuff.
Yep.
The thing that I love about British television is they don't have it go on for 15 seasons just because they can.
Yes.
You know, it's like Life on Mars. Two
yep.
seasons, done.
Right, and they even felt bad about, like, they're like, you know, we figure we can maybe get one more season in, but we don't want to push it. And tell that to the Quantum Leap people.
Yeah, and I love, like, Hex. Hex was a really good show.
Hex was cool, yep.
Hex was a lot of, was, you know, British Buffy was a lot of fun.
Yep.
What else am I like? Of course, Prime Suspect. You know, Manhunter wouldn't exist without the great Jane Tennyson.
You bet. What'd you think of that final story?
Oh, I loved it.
Pretty cool, yeah.
It was everything I wanted it to be. It was, if the Raiders of the Lost Ark 4 had been that good, it would be all would be right with the world. No, I thought it was amazing, and I would drink Helen Mirren's bathwater. I just think that she is such an amazing actress. I got to meet her once, and I just ran up to her, and I try not to, you know, because I live out in L.A., I try not to go up to celebrities and be like, oh, I'm a big fan, unless it's someone I really, really just can't help myself with. And I saw her, and I went up to her, and I said, Ms. Mirren, I'm sorry to bug you. She was in line for popcorn at a movie. And I said, this was right when Gosford Park was on. I'm like,
okay.
I'm a huge Prime Suspect fan, and I really hope you get a nomination for Gosford Park. She's like, oh, thank you, dear. That's very lovely. That's all. She was awesome. I was beaming for weeks after meeting Helen Mirren.
Very cool, man.
Cool.
Man, and, you know, she really is amazing. And you look at her entire career. I mean, she is really
hot.
Thank you. Yes, she is.
I know that's coming from a middle-aged gay man, but, I mean, I think she's sexier now than most American starlets are in their 20s. I don't know why. I don't know what it is, and maybe I'm making a rash generalization among straight men here, but I think, you know, if I was straight, I would be dating older women. I think women who have the miles and own their way they look are so much sexier. You look at a Susan Sarandon or Jessica Lange before she jokerized her face, or Tina Turner is 68 years old. Look at her.
I haven't seen her lately, but I did see her 10 years ago, and yeah, she looked pretty damn good 10 years ago.
You know, I've never looked that good. You know, and the same with Helen Mirren. You know, Helen Mirren's just, you know, she looks great for a 60-year-old woman, but there's such a sensuality and a comfort in her own skin that it's just really, really attractive.
That's cool. What I also think, as a hetero guy in his 40s, I will say that I think as we get older, we do kind of look at, I think men in general just look at women and say, you know, if I were such and such age, yeah, that she's all right. And I think Helen Mirren is one of those women that fits the bill on that, definitely.
And she can carry on a conversation. You know, looks fade.
Sure.
No matter how pretty you are, we've all read the picture of Dorian Gray.
Yes.
And you know, and once again, someone who is so good at what they do, whether you're a plumber or an actor or a painter, if you're good at what you do and you love what you do, there's something attractive about you.
That's
because
cool.
You realize when you see those people that love what they do, how lucky we are if we get to do what we love. Because
you bet.
So many people don't. So many people do, by circumstance, do what they need to survive or what they think they should do. And, you know.
No, that's the beauty of being a creative person. I absolutely agree with you. And being able to make a living off of it. I know what you mean. That's awesome, man. And you know, before I forget, because when we were talking earlier, it reminded me, Gatos is on this first arc. Is he ongoing with the series?
He's the regular artist.
Fantastic, man. Good for you.
Yeah, I told him he can't leave.
That's
outstanding. Like I said, I'm not one to trumpet my own work, but if you liked 31, I just read the final proofs for 32 today, and I'm really, really happy with that. I think it's a really good issue. I think we're all really firing on all cylinders here, so hopefully we can continue.
That's great.
So I want to do the book as long as I can. I would love to get up to issue 100.
Any other cons beyond San Diego or pre-San Diego? Are you going to Heroes or Chicago?
No, not really. One, for budgetary reasons.
I hear you.
It's a big expense. And two, it's an exhausting thing to do. And three, unlike, you know, artists, I don't really have anything I can do to offset the expense of the con unless I'm an invited guest, offsetting the expense of hotel and all that stuff. It's just, you know, especially now. With the way the economy is.
Oh, I know. No, believe me, man.
I never really noticed the economy until 2 weeks ago in my entire life. I'm like, wow, the grocery store is really expensive. And wow, gas is almost $5 a gallon. Wow, I've actually not chosen not to drive to places.
No, I hear you. I mean,
I'm an American. I'm a consumer. I don't have to think about these things. But no, so the short answer, it's cut through all that nonsense I just spouted. San Diego's pretty much it. I'm probably going to be doing the show in Spain that I did last year. I'm trying to do that every year because it was the best experience I've ever had. It was just amazing.
Yeah, that doesn't suck. I don't blame you.
Spain certainly doesn't suck, but you know, it was also unlike an American con. This event is sponsored by the Spanish government. It's in a city called Aviles in northern Spain. Last year was their 13th annual. It's more of a celebration of the art form than it is a commercial thing. You know, people come and ask for sketches and stuff like that, but it's not about, you know, all the people want the sketches personalized, so you know they're not going up on eBay.
Sure.
And there's kind of we're treated with almost a celebrity. I mean, I was interviewed by two different TV networks and in three different papers, and we had a press conference with the mayor of the city and all that sort of thing. But it was very much like a summer camp. You know, I got to hang out with old friends and make new friends and hang out with legends. You know, that's where I met Michael Golden for the first time. And
cool.
Liam Sharp and Dougie Braithwaite and Mark Buckingham and, you know, all these great people. And it was just, I was there for, you know, it's like a 10-day thing. And it was just, it just reinvigorated me and made me remember why I love comics and what a great kind of limitless medium we get to work in. So
is Manhunter playing well in Spain, or, you know, I mean?
Yeah, Manhunter actually does really well in Spain.
That's cool.
Yeah, it was really, really weird, and I have all the issues that are all the Spanish issues that are really, really cool, and I want to do an arc. I have an idea for an arc that actually takes place in Europe, dealing with extradition laws and everything. And one of the guys who was the organizers of the show that I did in Spain is actually a judge, a criminal judge, in Spain. So he's gonna help me, you know. I bent his ear when I was there about, you know, extradition law and that sort of thing. So I definitely would love to have Manhunter visit Aviles, where I was, because it's a great town.
Well, dude, I appreciate the time, and really good luck with Manhunter, because it's I'm glad to see it back, and I think you're off to a good start. And again, so glad that you got a wonderful co-creator in Michael Gatos to work with. And
And also too, I need to make sure I definitely put a shout out to Jose Villarrubia, who is our colorist.
Fantastic.
Who, in addition to being a brilliant colorist, is a dear friend and an awesome human being. So to have him, you know, work on Manhunter is an absolute honor, because, you know, having someone that talented, you know, I don't know how many Eisner Awards he has. And, you know, I think he and Mike together, after seeing what they did on that issue of New Avengers a couple months ago.
Oh, yeah.
I instantly called up Joan, and I'm like, could we get Jose? And she's like, already on it. So.
No, I understand, man, and I'm glad that, you know, Dan thought enough of the character and thought enough of you to keep the book alive and bring it back. And it's also
the fans. I am completely flabbergasted by the amount of goodwill that Manhunter has engendered in so many people. You know, we might only have 17 or 18,000 readers, but they are all pretty vocal people. And to literally have a book canceled and uncanceled twice over the course of 6 months is, one, unprecedented, two, exhausting, but three, ultimately, incredibly flattering. And I take the responsibility very seriously, you know, because I love these characters just as much as the fans do, and I don't want to do wrong by them, so...
Well, it's a good character and so far a good story, and issue 31 is a great way to come back. It just started just a week or so ago as far as when it came out last week?
Yeah, it came out last Wednesday.
There you go. Okay, so first week in July is issue 32?
Yeah, that's going to be our regular place the first week of each month, so there'll be two issues out by San Diego.
Excellent. So check your newsstands for 31. And
if you're coming to San Diego, anybody, I will be there. I will be at the DC booth. I'll be doing a bunch of panels. I'll be at other places, and Michael Gatos will be there as well.
Unfortunately, again, power surges conspire against me, and the very end of my conversation with Mark got nipped off. But again, it was just us saying thank you to each other, so we salvaged most of the conversation for you tonight. And as always, a pleasure to talk to Mark Andraco. Hope to speak to him again in the near future. A couple announcements as we wrap up. Don't forget, Wizard World Chicago is coming up. And it's in my backyard, so you can be sure that Word Balloon will be out there at the convention. In fact, there's a podcasting panel featuring my buddies from Around Comics, Alter Ego, The Comic Book Queers, Comicology, Collected Comics Library, a couple other shows as well. And we're all going to be sitting in a panel moderated by DC writer Sean McKeever of Teen Titans fame. And it should be fun, and if you have any interest in seeing the panel and heading to the convention, it's going to be on Friday, June 27th at 2 p.m. So I hope to see you out there. This episode of Word Balloon was brought to you by In Stock Trades at InStockTrades.com. Don't forget, In Stock Trades has a wide variety of trade paperbacks, hardcovers, essentials, showcases, archives, absolute editions, omnibus editions, and more, all at up to 35% off, with orders over $50 receiving free shipping. And once again, Mark Andraco and Manhunter are well represented at InStockTrades.com. All four volumes of the Manhunter series are available through In Stock Trades. The first one retails at $12.99, Street Justice. At In Stock Trades, it's just $8.18. The other trades retail for $17.99, but at In Stock Trades, just $11.33. For all the details, head over to InStockTrades.com. Thanks again for listening. This is John Suntress. Hope to see you at Wizard World at the convention in Chicago. Otherwise, you can always find us on the internet at WordBalloon. We're at iTunes.com. Of course, at Newsarama, at myspace.com/WordBalloon, comicspace.com/WordBalloon. And as always, questions or comments about the show, just send me an email, john@WordBalloon.com. Thanks again. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2008.